Blog Here we go. Radio.
Woohoo!
Hit it.
Welcome to the Koi Pond and Water Garden Podcast. A podcast for the aquatically obsessed. With your host, Mike Gannon, the Pond Hunter. In pursuit of all things aquatic, bringing you koi pond and water garden advice straight from the field. The show starts now.
Hey, everybody. Hey. Welcome to episode 79 of the Koi Pond Water Garden Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Cannon, and I'm very excited to have a guest with us in this episode. We're going to be joined by Dr. Jesse Sanders, who is a fish veterinarian, a veterinarian and author of the book, How to Kill Your Koi. Her book can be found on Amazon. It has some really great reviews, and I'm happy to have her here on the Koi Pond Water Garden Podcast. And this episode is brought to you by That Pond. That Pond Place is the destination location for all things that are koi pond, water garden, and water feature related. That Pond Place has a huge selection of colorful koi and friendly goldfish, and a tremendous assortment of aquatic plants. All the supplies and equipment that you could need for a successful pond keeping experience. And while you're at That Pond Place, be sure to check out their driftwood forest, the largest collection of driftwood in the state of New Jersey. That Pond Place is conveniently located 1 hour outside of New York City, 30 minutes outside of the Lehigh Valley of Pennsylvania, and in the beautiful skylines of New Jersey. That Pond Place is 656 Route 57, Stewartsville, New Jersey, 908-329-6176. And of course, you can visit them at thatpondplace.com. Now let's talk to Dr. Jesse Sanders, fish veterinarian and author. Dr. Sanders, how are you?
I'm doing well, Mike. How are you?
Thanks so much for coming on to the podcast. I'm really happy to have you here.
Yes, thank you much for the invitation. I love talking about fish above all other things, so I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to your listeners.
Excellent, and I'm so glad you're here. We'll do a great podcast. We'll do a walkthrough on your book, How. And I've been building and working on koi ponds and all sorts of other pond-related items for almost 30 years, and I can tell you firsthand, it takes experience to know how to kill koi. So before we get into your book, tell me about your background.
So I graduated from veterinary school almost 10 years ago. And when I was in veterinary school, I had the kind of goal of becoming an aquarium veterinarian. I had been a marine biology undergraduate student, and during that time had the opportunity to volunteer at my local aquarium. So moving up through veterinary school, that was my goal, to become an aquarium veterinarian. Well, I don't know if you know anything about aquariums. There are, you know, limited positions, and the ones that are open get highly competitive. So I actually go ahead.
I learned a little bit about that. I actually worked at the New York Aquarium. And it is most certainly very competitive.
Positions. Usually you have to wait for someone to retire or they build a new aquarium, which obviously doesn't happen very often.
Not every day.
No. So as
That's
part
great.
Of my veterinary school curriculum, I had to go to 2 weeks in private practice and had found a wonderful mentor, Dr. Helen Sweeney. She works out of Buffalo, New York, and she had a small animal, exotics, and fish clinic. She actually has her own book on the fundamentals of ornamental fish health.
Yeah, you know, so, I actually did a program with Dr. Sweeney at the university. There was a koi program down there she was part of quite a few years ago. She's wonderful.
Yes, she's who I want to be when I grow up. She is just a fantastic person, in addition to being a wonderful fish vet.
Yeah.
So I got to work with her for 2 weeks, and it was just the most inspirational, wonderful 2 weeks of my veterinary kind of student curriculum. So that really kind of pulled me off the path of being an aquarium veterinarian and put me on the private practice side of things. So after I graduated, moved to the West Coast, looked around for a position where, you know, I do small animal, large animal mix, and then I add fish onto that. Well, nobody really wanted what I was selling. I think they were very confused by the fish component. So I went ahead and opened my own all aquatics exclusive practice, and we just had our 10th anniversary last month.
That's amazing. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
That's absolutely awesome. So it's you're the owner of Aquatic Services, and you're based out of California. That's pretty amazing. And, you know, I've always admired the veterinary field. It seems like there's a lot of adventure that kind of gets mixed into your profession as well. What's kind of like adventure that you've had as a veterinarian?
So, I mean, when I first started this practice, I thought it would be pretty much exclusively marine tanks. I really didn't have much experience with koi except what I'd had with Dr. Sweeney. And coming out and starting this practice, I mean, if you're in the marine hobby, you're usually fairly savvy about, you know, what you need to do in quarantine and making sure certain species get along. With freshwater, and especially koi, there's really no, like, it comes with an idea of let's put a big hole in our backyard and throw some fish in it. And that's sometimes all the research that goes into it. So the koi owners, especially, you know, the last time you might have had hands on that fish was this cute little 3-inch, 4-inch fish. Just the fact that I can get the fish out of the pond, that let alone do an exam, give it medication and all that, that is one of the most, you know, awesome things that my clients watch, this, that I'm able to get this fish out of the pond.
Right. It is not easy. I tell people that when they're like, well, you know, I'll grab my fish. I'm like, just be careful. It's not as easy as it may sound. Like, that's funny. You have the book, but I also see you have a health and welfare program. It's a certification program that you offer up. So you definitely do outreach, and this is something that's open to professionals, but hobbyists as well. Do I understand that correctly?
Yes, the program, so it's 12 weeks, and it is open to everyone everywhere. We've had a couple of recorded sessions, but most of the sessions are live with myself and other veterinarians and pond professionals, just sharing with people how to take better care of their koi. But yes, it's open to anyone, and if you miss the live sessions, the recordings are all available. We have handouts for water quality and how to, you know, look at fish foods from a different perspective, maybe try to ignore some of the marketing, and we just want to make sure that that resource is available to everyone.
Yeah, it's really a great thing. I'll give the information at the end of this. People can look into that as well. Aquariums at home?
I have a goldfish pond. They are currently being fattened up. They're a little bit small. We're going to be doing some feeding trials with them for a couple different food items. It's nothing that's terminal or end of life, but right now they're a little too small for my liking, so they are currently just getting beefed up a little bit, and hopefully we'll start doing some GI transit studies in the spring.
And I bet they're very relieved that your book was not goldfish.
I mean, I could have written that book as well, but it's a lot different, especially with goldfish. You know, they can kind of straddle that indoor versus outdoor world, and
yeah,
there is plans to write that book eventually.
That's great. So I read your book. I read your book cover to cover. Excuse me.
Awesome.
I really enjoyed it. It was my vacation reading. So I got to sit on the beach and have a couple of rum drinks and read. I liked it very much.
Good.
My quick assessment. So I think as far as the book goes, it's a good size book. I got through it in a few reads. I thought it was laid out really, really nicely. It's comprehensive, and it gets into detail without getting I think, without getting too into the weeds or too, so it's really a great book. Like with most books, I didn't necessarily agree with everything, but it's such a broad topic. Can you agree on everything? But otherwise, it's really a solid book. It's packed with really helpful information for people who are involved in the hobby or really style of keeping ponds. And most of the advice, I think, can be applied to pond keeping in the broadest sense. So, you know, water gardeners, wildlife ponds, everybody can kind of, I think, benefit from your book. How long did it take you to write the book?
So writing it, it took a couple years here and there. So if you've read any of the material on our website, especially our blog, some of the information might sound very familiar. So it took about a year to put it together, kind of fill in the pieces, and then edit. The layout was a joint effort by myself and my publisher because I had printed another Koi book that's very small, and I just wanted somebody to kind of help me do the full layout and make sure that it had a little bit more of a cohesive flow, which I very much appreciate that you were able to note. And I didn't want to make it, you know, like a super technical manual that, you know, you had to pull out a dictionary to decipher. I wanted to make it accessible, especially to those people who are maybe newer to the hobby and just wanted a place to start from.
Yeah. Yeah. It really is. It's a great place to start from. And the book is, and each chapter begins with a koi a myth, and there's lots of myths out there. So let's take a walk through the book, if that's all right.
Oh yes, absolutely.
And chapter one, the myth for chapter one was my koi dealer would never sell me a sick fish, and this is you kind of go into the health aspects of keeping fish. Can you talk about chapter one a little bit and kind of perhaps give us a summary?
Yes. So chapter one is really focused on biosecurity and quarantine, which unfortunately, I mean, I can only speak for the vendors that I've worked with personally. I sure hope this is different elsewhere. But a lot of fish, you know, moving through these pet stores, they might be moving very quickly and therefore not showing any clinical signs, or they've just been at the facility for so long, you know, putting them through the stress of packing them up, putting them in a bag, throwing them in the car, and then dumping them into this foreign environment with new fish can be very stressful. And it's that stress that unfortunately can diminish any sort of immune function. And if there's bacteria or parasites riding along on that new inquiry, it can very easily spread to the entire pond and wipe out a lot of fish. So we just want to make sure owners are aware that guarantee that this fish is perfectly healthy. Biology just doesn't work that way. And anyone that offers up that guarantee should be taken very skeptically.
Yeah, I would second that. That you really can't. You can't give any guarantees, even with the quarantine. Now, your quarantine that you're suggesting, 4 to 6 week quarantine period. And during that time, obviously, the fish are kind of going through everything to make sure that they're picking out with or have any observable diseases. But you can never give a guarantee, even after quarantine. That's something that I think a lot of people don't realize, and make a quarantine fish is a guaranteed healthy fish.
Yeah. And I mean, what quarantine means to one facility or one person might vary widely. I mean, some people only quarantine their fish for a week, which if you actually look in the literature to see like what potential pathogens are there and how long they actually take to present, that's really not anything that, you know, you might catch within a week. So it's very important that if somebody says something is quarantined, that you actually are able to understand what that quarantine means.
Historically, quarantine is usually about a 40-day period, somewhere around there. It comes from maritime law, where they would quarantine ships before coming into port because of bringing in all sorts of exotic diseases and such. So quarantine is definitely, I love that as a topic. I think it's a really interesting topic, and you're 100% right. Even dealing with clients or customers who have quarantined on their own, I've had people say, yeah, I quarantined a week and everything seemed great, or I gave it 2 weeks. And, you know, not that there's any guaranteed period again, but quarantine should be several weeks for sure. And again, no guarantees, everybody, just so you know. There's never any guarantees,
no.
So take
never.
That with a grain of salt. And then in chapter two, the myth was koi do fine in a small pond, and they only grow to the size of their environment. Let's unpack that a little bit.
Yeah, so that really kind of leads into, you know, how much room do koi actually need? And it's very hard to kind of nail this right on the head as far as, you know, what might kind of cross into to the line of a fish that is stunted and not having enough room and resources versus those fish that just kind of stay small. Since we are talking about carp, essentially common carp, I mean, out in the wild, these things get enormous. And I have had lots of clients with ponds that we're talking less than 500 gallons that have 6, 7, 8 koi packed into this tiny environment. And
yeah.
What we see most commonly is they're just spreading diseases around left and right. So yes, it's the increased contact, but again, these fish, they like to have a little bit of room. They need room to kind of spread out and swim and grow. And I really rather than owners, you know, oh, we'll start with this many and then we'll get rid of X amount of fish when they outgrow the pond. I would rather, you know, start with a few fish, but then can grow into the pond because that's just going to be less stress overall. And then you don't have to worry about that, you know, as an eventuality down the line.
Yeah. I see that as almost a chronic issue out in the world. When I'm out in the field every year, you know, I deal with a couple of hundred ponds essentially as far as us offering services or maintenance or whatever the case. And overstocking is pretty like across the board, including myself. I mean, my pond admittedly is overstocked. So yeah, it's definitely an issue for people to consider, and the you know, what can happen due to overstocking, which, like you had mentioned, disease and stuff like that. I remember when I first started keeping fish, you know, goldfish and guppies, I think were mostly what I was keeping. But I was always told that goldfish only grow in their container. And I was told that is because they secrete a growth-inhibiting hormone. So as long as we're on the myth, can you clear that up for me? Is that true?
So that growth inhibiting hormone comes from an overload of cortisol, which is produced by stress. So it is the fish's, you know, own body response to, I am going to run out of room, I have to stay small. It's that same stress response that's going to inhibit your growth, your reproduction, and your immune function as well. It's basically a fish trying to preserve what little space they have because, again, these fish, they aren't really, you know, unless you're like a silly little fancy goldfish that's ever going to get big just because your spine's been flattened into an M shape. They, again, are another species that can potentially, I mean, we've had goldfish the size of dinner plates come into our clinic. So again, I mean, these little fish, we've had a lot of goldfish that have been in, you know, a tiny bowl, heaven forbid, or a little tiny 5 gallon tank. And as soon as you move them to a bigger tank, they grow a little bit. They start swimming around and they just have this enhanced vibrancy that the owners are completely oblivious that they were even causing it in the first place just because all that this information is out there.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of, when I was, again, going back to my childhood of keeping fish, goldfish were always considered small, you know, they were just small fish. And I remember at one point, I sold it many years ago, but I had an this as well as, you know, working with ponds and stuff. And we had one tank. I mean, I saw it several times, but one tank that we were working on where they'd be goldfish. It was just like goldfish you win at the high school fair. And they were tremendous. They were absolutely tremendous. I was shocked how big they can actually be. really give them the room. And they're impressive. They're beautiful and colorful and friendly, and they're great fish. I think they're very underrated.
Yes, agreed.
You'd mentioned in Chapter 2 some other fish that mix well with koi, and including the goldfish that we talked about. But high fin shark, catfish, and sturgeon were some of the ones that you talked about as well. Can you mention something about them?
Sure. So the high fin sharks, they are also technically a member of the carp family, just like koi and goldfish. And these guys also start out, you know, cute little 3-inchers in the pet store. And I have seen these guys over a foot long. Because, again, these guys are carp. Carp can grow very, very large. They tend to be more kind of towards the herbivorous side of the spectrum. So they like munching on algae. Some people like them, you know, just for some contrast in a pond, provided you can see them. These guys are very dark and are bottom feeders, so it's kind of hard to find them in a pond. Catfish,
right.
These are, again, commonly added to ponds just for some diversity. For the most part, they are channel catfish or just kind of a common catfish. They might be the albino variety, but I have seen catfish. This is back to my aquarium days. It was a catfish that bit an arowana in half.
Oh my gosh.
Didn't even get the whole thing in his mouth. And we just came in that morning and it was half, the back half of an arowana. And I have seen fish mysteriously disappear from the pond, and you know the catfish goes off feed for a couple days. So for the most part, as long as your catfish is well fed and, you know, knows that there's an easy meal coming, they're usually okay. The sturgeon,
right.
They don't like that warm water. So it really depends on where you are and kind of what their water quality is sitting at. And make sure that, again, some of these sturgeon get enormous. They're going to be even bigger than your koi. So it's really important that if you're going to have those, make sure that you have the space, the correct water temperature, and that they are actually legal in your state, because some of those are not legal species.
Yeah. I have no experience in keeping sturgeon, but they definitely can be a substantial fish. You know, one of the things I see a lot of people think about catfish is that catfish are going to keep your pond clean. And I always tell people that is not the case.
Nope,
in my opinion,
all.
Yeah, once they know that you're feeding them food, they are not about cleaning up ponds at all. And to your point, too, people really think catfish can live in harmony with goldfish and other fish for extended periods of time. And then one day just arbitrarily say, hey, you look like take down their pond mates or tank mates.
Yeah.
So be careful of those catfish.
Yeah.
I went into Chapter 3, and the myth is I don't need to test water. Of course, you do. But one of the takeaways I took is the test strips. You basically characterize them as being kind of not great, pretty useless, essentially.
So we had a little store for a couple of years, and we would actually take test strips that were fresh out of the container from multiple companies. We just did one day, we just, you know, opened a bunch of products and we're like, we're going to test these all at the same time. And we were amazed, not only the variability between the different brands, but, you know, within a fresh thing of test strips, we were getting conflicting information. So unfortunately the owners, you know, store those outside in our little tiny, you know, kind of airtight container. I mean, it's better than absolutely nothing, but I those little, you know, liquid-based test kits are so readily available. Yes, it's a little bit harder to read, especially some of those reagents are not kind of, you know, going from red to slightly darker red, but it's so much easier, and you get much more reliable results just with that little tiny upgrade that we really don't recommend using those strips.
Yeah. And in that chapter, you give a list of water parameters and what they mean. You know, a lot of people may know what they're for, but not necessarily know what it means that they're testing for those things. I've always said to, when it comes to water testing, my customers and clients, just to to be very careful when testing pH, because a lot of people, I feel like pH is a, it's a really varying water quality parameter, whereas you could test your pond at 6 in the morning and test it at 6 p.m. and you're going to get two different readings. So it's kind of something that changes throughout the day. And I see people
correct.
Get very reactive. They'll read their pH and it's a snapshot of that moment. And you have to understand why you're getting that reading, because perhaps it rained at 4 in the morning for 15 minutes and you didn't know that. And now you're testing your pH and reacting to. So I like to tell people to be very careful with pH and don't react too quickly. Monitor it over a period of time to get kind of an average of where your pH stays. Would you agree with that type of assessment?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. I mean, in that chapter itself, we actually have a graph of a pond that we were testing, you know, throughout the day, and the pH varies, you know, from 7.2 all the way up to 7.6, just depending on the type of day, the different biologic activity. And everyone, I don't know why this started that, you know, a pond pH has to be at 7 exactly, which I'm sorry, with a giant koi pond is pretty much impossible unless you were on top of it every single minute of the day. And I mean, the water out here in California is about 8, 8.5 consistently. And that is perfectly fine for koi. It's very important that you try to keep it, you know, fairly consistent as best as you can. It's really those dramatic pH swings, you know, going from a 6 to a 7 in, say, an hour, that would be something that would be problematic rather than like a slow rise from, you know, 6.8 to 7.4 throughout the course of the day.
Yeah. Yep. Another part of the chapter is the question of, do I need to heat my pond in cold weather? What's your advice on that?
So, again, that kind of comes from where we are in California, at least, you know, in the Bay Area. It's not going to be consistently freezing temperatures. So, for the most part, you know, your fish in this area, they have it pretty good. We do have some clients that like to heat their ponds, and it's perfectly fine if you want to. I remember from Dr. Sweeney, and I'm sure you have this in your area too, that for the most part, you know, the pond can ice over entirely. But as long as your fish aren't frozen themselves, have oxygen and some room to kind of move their gills and swim around, they can overwinter. And then, you know, coming into the spring, sometimes they'll have a rough transition depending on what the temperature is doing. But as long as you're providing them, you know, good water chemistry and when they're hungry, a good diet, they can do just fine, you know, coming up from below the depths under the ice into the spring.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. And then you kind of finish it off where there's some other things that people can expect, to like chlorine, dissolved oxygen, heavy metals, when it comes to what they're testing for. And there's a good, like you said, there's a good chart there to take to kind of help people monitor that. Water quality is really important, but I usually suggest to people to kind of look at stuff and don't be too reactive, because sometimes they can cause as many problems as they're trying to fix.
Yeah. And obviously write down your readings. I think that's the main reason I put that chart in there, is because I don't trust your brain to remember what you tested that morning or the day before. Like, just write it down. So if you do start to notice, oh, my pH, you know, was up in the 8s a couple months ago, and now we're down in the 6s. Like, that would be something you probably have to look into more. But again, without those historical levels, you're like, well, I think this is close to what I tested yesterday, but, you know, I'm not sure.
Yeah. I definitely wouldn't be sure. I think it's a great idea. In chapter 4 of your book, you get into how to keep your pond clean. The myth is, my pond is all natural and never needs. I've heard that before.
So, I mean, with any pond, you are creating an artificial pond structure. And in anything that is artificial, it's not going to take care of itself. I mean, you can certainly cut down on the amount of maintenance that you do, but it's really important to make sure, especially that you know, your pond's not building up with a bunch of sludge, which if it loses enough its oxygen, it can become anaerobic, and that will release hydrogen sulfide, and making sure that your, you know, your filters are able to do their job efficiently and that they're not clogged up with a bunch of, you know, poop from the fish.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, one of the points that you make is that minimal maintenance really does go a long way. To maintaining your pond and taking care of the systems. When you're filtering, you kind of broke it down into there's the mechanical filtration, electrical filtration. You can filter. I almost don't consider them filters in the sense, but ultraviolet clarifiers, they do. Let's talk about mechanical filtration a little bit, which is basically just the act of removing particulate matter, leaves or floating material down to just floating particles. You mentioned some ways to do mechanical skimming. Can you, mechanical filtration, can you go over that a little bit?
Yes. So hopefully if your pond was designed by somebody who, you know, thought about the process, I mean, the mechanical filtration in a pond really starts with the skimmers that are, you know, taking some of the leaves and floating debris off and catching those in a little basket. But obviously there's going to be kind of a size that they're able to catch versus that's going to move on down the line. So obviously if your tank, or excuse me, your pond has a bottom drain, that's another great way that, you know, those particulates are going to move into your mechanical filter. So a lot of the times this might be a settling tank. This could be a drum or a sieve filter, but it also might be, you know, your pressurized feed filter, which is also doing some of the biologic filtration as well. So again, within those pressurized feed filters, you have these little tiny plastic beads that will, yes, catch all those smaller particles, but over time they're going to get, you know, really clogged up. So again, doing that minimal backwash once a week to kind of keep all that excess debris from building up and really clogging up your filter is essential. But a lot of mechanical filtration components are kind of, for what I've seen, kind of left off the pond, and they're expecting, you know, your bead filter to do both the mechanical and a lot of the biologic filtration as well.
Yeah, which, to your point, really does put a lot of strain onto those pressure filters and those other those methods of filtration. It really does make them clog really quickly. And especially in some ponds, more established ponds, you know, that are just, or there's a lot of stuff going on, excuse me, inside of them. And it can really, I've seen pressure filters get clogged up in days. I mean, very, very quickly. Some of the other biological filtration you mentioned, the pressure filters we talked about, gravel filters, Bakke shower. The gravel filter, I think, I didn't see you use the term, but that's relating perhaps to wetland type of filtration or bog.
Yeah, it's kind of similar. Gravel is, you know, one step up from the old school sand filters. I don't know if you've had experience with that, but we used to have those back in my aquarium days, and those things were just disgusting and filthy. Yes, they do, you know, polish the water up quite nicely, but when you're adding in, you know, plants and other biologics, as far as that bog filter is concerned, again, you want to make sure that there's adequate oxygen moving through those levels, because with thick plant roots, with gravel that just gets like super compacted, again, it's at the risk of forming anaerobic bacterial colonies, which use sulfur as a food source, and if those are ever disturbed and reoxygenated, it will kill off the bacteria and release that lovely rotten egg, or, you know, that hydrogen sulfide into the water, which can be toxic to fish. So it's just something you got to, you know, kind of keep maintained a little bit.
Yeah, and I would agree with that, because we have built lots of wetland filters, those type of that methodology of filtration. And it really is important to make sure that it's built correctly. You're using the right grain size of gravels. You're layering them in the correct way to make sure that everything flows the way it should. There's a lot of very good equipment. It used to be years ago the approach to building gravel themselves was very different. There's much better equipment now. You can use aqua blocks and different types of filtration to filter component, really make a gravel filter very efficient and make the maintenance of it much easier, for sure. And then you where you get kind of that sulfury smell sometimes in some of the ponds, which I've certainly come across. I'm glad to see it's been fairly rare to come across that level of, I consider it mismanagement. You know, all ponds need to be maintained. And if a pond is getting to the point where it's releasing sulfury smell from it, that pond is not being maintained correctly. So don't ever let your ponds get to that point, folks.
Or if you're going to clean them, you know, get the fish out of the way so they don't have to smell it as you're releasing it.
Yeah, absolutely. The few ponds that I've worked on that have really been like that across the board, they are very neglected ponds. And it's usually something, I don't mean the person who's keeping it is not doing it right. I mean, but for example, it might be somebody bought a house that has a pond that hasn't been cleaned in years and years, and I'm the first person to go and touch this thing in 10 years. That's where you get kind of those anaerobic type of conditions. And surprisingly, I mean, I've seen fish living in them. I'm not saying it's good for them. It's probably like humans living in, bad air quality in a city or something like that. But it's amazing what the fish can acclimate to sometimes.
Yeah, it's definitely a thing.
I am a big. There's one part that I will. I'm a big fan of using bacteria, but I know that you had mentioned that in your experience, the bacteria is not really very effective. Let's talk about that a little. So, bacteria is something that I always try to explain to people that bacteria, I mean, there's a lot that goes into it. Bacteria, it could be its own podcast. It's a really broad topic when you really get down to it. But what we're talking about, I think, more specifically for your treatments. And, I've had them, because we deal with so many ponds, I get all sorts of different feedback. Most of it tends to be positive feedback for people who have used bacteria to, you know, try to clarify green water and stuff like that. And I've had success with it as well, but not 100% of the time. Do you recommend, what are your thoughts on using bacteria? It just, does it let the natural processes happen, or what are your thoughts?
So again, I mean, there's, like you said, there's lots of different bacterial products on the market, and obviously some of those are going to be better made than others. So are we talking, you know, the bacteria that get your nitrogen cycle going, or this is the bacteria that like clean up goo in your pond? Which category are we going for here?
Right. Well, I would say both, because both of those problems are what virtual is. So some people are wanting to establish their ponds, other people are trying to remediate issues with high nutrient levels.
Okay. So as far as those bacterial kind of cultures that are supposed to, you know, quick start your pond, automatically start your biologic filters, we've actually done studies looking at a bunch of different products to see, you know, how fast everything would be converted over to nitrate. So again, your nitrogen cycle goes from ammonia, nitrite to nitrate. So we had just a bunch of goldfish tanks that were set up, and we were using different products throughout. And unfortunately, they didn't really speed up the nitrogen cycle at all, except one that maybe made it a week shorter. And then there was also another published study done. I believe it was out of, I want to say it was either North Carolina or Mississippi. They repeated the study with, you know, the same products, I think, again, using goldfish, and none of them really did the job. So obviously when it comes to the bacteria living in your biologic filter, it's not going to be the same for every pond. And I suspect, you know, a lot of these bacteria are cultured at a certain pH. And, you know, if your pH doesn't match what the bacteria like, they're not going to be happy and die off. So, again, it really depends on your individual pond and the requirements, you know, of that biologic filter in particular. And that's not going to be the same across the board. And, you know, whatever you are starting with, that might not be what you end up with down the line. So, again, if anyone's using this product, I would still highly recommend, you know, testing all of your water quality parameters, your nitrogen parameters specifically, your ammonia, nitrite, nitrate. And again, just kind of watching to make sure that those all go where they need to. And then for those bacteria products that, you know, clean up piles of sludge, thing like that, those, again, are going to work to kind of outcompete some of those algae for the other resources in the pond. So, again, all the food that the algae uses, sometimes, depending, again, on the bacterial colony, they might be able to use that resource first and decrease the amount of algae or the waste that's in the bottom. Again, it really depends on the other biologic components of your pond. So, again, that's kind of, I understand, you know, seeing those various results. And I just don't want owners to, you know, we're just going to add this bottle of product and it's going to take care of, you know, this giant pile of sludge on the bottom of our pond rather than just, you know, getting it out with a vacuum or a shop vac and just taking the extra effort to make sure that their pond is clean. I think just people are too reliant on these products because they're just so easy, like easy to apply. You just dump the bottle in. It doesn't take any more work than that.
Yeah. Yeah. And to your point, minimum maintenance can go a very long way. You can't always just pour something in to get the results. Chapter 5, you go into ultraviolet lights, clarifiers, and the is that ultraviolet lights treat all algae and fish disease. Why is that a myth?
So, again, usually we put the UV lights in with the filtration chapter, but since there is this specific myth, it is a very, that's the shortest chapter in the entire book. But UV sterilizers will only zap what they come in contact with. And again, that's going to be within that little sleeve that, you know, is hopefully passing after all the filtration takes place. So again, it's left with the little tiny live particulates. But again, it's not going to do anything for the algae that is in your pond. So all that string algae that is fastened to the side of your pond, that's not going to be treated by the UV light. And all of the diseases are going to be pretty much on your fish. Yes, there might be some larval and free swimming stages that are going to get zapped by the UV light. But unless your fish is sitting in front of your filter intake for 24 hours and not, you know, shedding it to the rest of the pond, coming into contact with the other fish, it's really not going to decrease your chances of your fish actually getting sick.
Yeah. And even with the free swimming or planktonic diseases, they have to pass through at a certain flow rate. It has to be calibrated. An ultraviolet has to be calibrated to treat different pathogens. It's not like you can do X amount of gallons per hour and everything will be by it. And that's, I think, the most important point of the chapter that you have in there is that the UV does not kill all algae. And that is, it's definitely a misconception that I've had and always have people come to me again and again, hey, I'm going to get a UV light so all my algae goes away. And I always ask people, is your water clear and you're trying to get rid of algae that's on your rock liner or those kind of things, or is your water green? Because that's the only thing, in my experience, the UV light really, truly helps with.
Yes, and then usually your pond will turn from a lovely green to brown.
Yeah, exactly. I tell people it hides the problem. I mean, if it's you know, pea soup, that kind of thing, you have elevated nutrients and whatever else is going on. But that means that there's something not functioning correctly with your processing nutrients quickly or efficiently, so it's allowing them to elevate. And the UV light will make your water clear, but it doesn't get rid of the problem. And it's always better to address the problem rather than hide it by way of using an ultraviolet clarifier. So, yeah, chapter five, very, very important chapter. Chapter six is, to me, is a biggie. That's a big one. That's about nutrition and feeding fish and foods, and is that the most expensive food is the best food. How could that possibly be wrong?
Yes. Well, so this is actually part of our koi class. So I just gave this lecture last night. So we actually, in that, we go through all of the, like, I picked just five, you know, common maintenance brands, and we broke them down, you know, based on what sort of protein they had, their fat, and then, you know, how many protein sources were there versus, you know, how much actually had to be supplemented. And again, those companies that are using, you know, relatively cheap ingredients, if they are very aggressive on their marketing, they can absolutely charge more for a bag of food, and people just won't question it.
Yeah, sure. If it's a cool-looking bag, you know, it just it's got to be a good food.
Yeah, it all comes down to marketing with any pet food. Cats, dogs, horses, fish, it all comes down to marketing.
Yeah. That's true. In that chapter, you give some really good criteria to evaluate foods, and you talk about the different types of food, floating food versus sinking food, as well as quantities, because that's always a big question, too. How should I feed my fish? That's like an FAQ. How much should I feed my fish? My answer is always, I can't really tell you how much to feed them, like a quarter cup. Because the quantities that they're going to want are dependent on many different things, including water temperatures, time of year, et cetera. Do you have any good advice on gauging the quantities to feed?
Oh, goodness. Unfortunately, no. So with all other pet foods, you know, it's by how much your animal weighs and then how many kilocalories are in that food. Well, obviously, you're not going to be weighing out your entire population of fish, and fish food is not listed by calories. So unfortunately, no, the one thing that would make the most sense isn't available. So, and again, I completely agree with you. It's going to depend on, you know, what's been going on in the pond. It's going to depend on how stressed out your fish are, the temperature, and that, you know, your pond, what your fish want to do at a specific temperature and, you know, time of day is going to vary completely differently from, you know, your neighbor right next door. So we have
exactly.
Some fish that, you know, like to take their time with their eating. You know, they're kind of nonchalant. They're going to come, make a pass, take a couple pellets, and, you know, it takes 20, 30 minutes to feed your fish. While other ponds, you know, all the food is sucked up in 20 to 30 seconds.
Yeah.
So it really comes down to, you know, just learning what your fish do over time and in different seasons. And obviously, if you're completely new to this, we do recommend, you know, doing little sprinkle feedings for about 5 minutes and just kind of gauging your fish's appetite depending on how fast they are consuming all that food.
Yep, exactly. And some great treats that you recommend too, like krill, leafy greens, zucchini, squash, banana, grapes, watermelon. All those kind of fun to offer your fish. And it's a great way to interact with them and to get them to kind of develop that trust with you as a pond keeper as well.
Yeah.
And there's nothing more fun than seeing
a
bunch of fish taking down watermelon.
Yeah, but there's some ponds that the fish just don't care for it. And it's really going to vary entirely. Like some ponds, you know, they've offered watermelon and the fish just to like, nah, we're good. But, you know, you throw some little zucchini pieces in there and they go nuts. And then other ponds just don't want lettuce. So sometimes it takes a little, you know, trial and error to see what your pond is really going to like.
Yeah, absolutely. Chapter 7 is a funny one because the myth is I don't need it. And coming from you, that had to have been a difficult chapter to deal with.
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, there's a lot of myths out there, coming down to veterinary care for koi. And, you know, the other myth that I could have put in this chapter is, you know, veterinarians don't know anything about fish. Why would I bother calling one? But, again, we have a lot of people in this hobby that, you know, they've heard this thing online. They've read this thing on the internet, which, as you know, everything on the internet must be true. And then they go and ask their friends for it, and they're like, oh, I have a friend, you know, has a dental practice, has a nurse friend, and we can get you, you know, the medications for these fish that are obviously going to be unlicensed, and if they're used inappropriately, can lead to a lot of antibacterial resistance. So,
yeah.
Again, there are some good sources out there. I mean, some pet stores and koi stores are better than others. There's some internet sites that have really done their research, but trying to, you know, go through the entire internet and pick out those that are good versus bad, I don't think anyone has enough time in the world to try and do that.
No.
So it really comes down to, you know, just kind of you read with, you know, just a little bit of data salt. And if you do have any questions, we do have resources for trying to find veterinarians in your area. I'm actively trying to train more of them just to make sure that even if people just have, you know, general questions, that they can get reliable answers.
Yeah. Yeah, fish care is emerging, and you do offer some good resources on how to find a vet. I used your resource, and I found a vet in my area, which was great. So chapter 8, don't try to save a koi, buy a new one. And what I actually took a quote from you because I think it's important for people to know, because sometimes people have, I don't mean this in the wrong way, but kind of an unrealistic expectation when it comes to fish keeping. And you say, and I agree, sometimes things right and your fish still may get sick and die. Things go wrong. And those are very true words. You know, a lot of people beat themselves up over it, or, you know, just rack their brains over what happened, what did I do, what's going on. And sometimes go wrong. Can you give a couple quick tips on how to tell if your fish is sick? You point to two things, specifically behavioral and physical.
Yeah, so it can be hard for especially newer owners to know if what their fish is doing is normal versus not. And we highly recommend if you're ever, you know, concerned about something to ask, you know, someone who's had more experience with koi or call your veterinarian that deals with fish. But when it comes to, you know, knowing if a fish is sick, we have our physical signs of disease and our behavioral signs of disease. Usually the physical are a little bit easier for people to notice, and that's, you know, redness of the skin. There's a hole in the side of your fish. They're missing some of their fin. It's something that's changing the external appearance of that fish. Now, the behavioral signs of disease, so this includes, you know, swimming funny, having inappropriate buoyancy, or even, you know, being not as hungry as they usually are. These can obviously take a little bit longer to appreciate, especially if you're new to your fish. So with, you know, any pond, we highly recommend that, you know, you do spend some time with them on a regular basis and try to, you know, figure out what is normal. Go visit other ponds, see if, you know, these fish look like yours. And if there's anything that you're ever confused about, don't just sit there and wait for it to get better. Ask somebody.
Yep, exactly. What an book. It's awesome information. I think your book is helpful to all pond keepers, whether they have koi or not. I really do. I think it's kind of a good general guide to fish keeping, pond keeping. And you have a couple other publications as well. Can you mention those?
Yes. So we also have a children's book series. It's called Boo and Bubbles. Basically, it follows a young girl getting her first aquarium. So this is a goldfish-specific book. The first book goes through, you know, bringing your fish home from the store, all the different equipment that you need, and how to set it up. The second one is called A Visit from the Fish Vet, and that brings in, you know, the maintenance that you do and what my role as a fish veterinarian is in the care of pet fish. And then the third book is called Meet Goldie, and it brings in a new fish into the tank with the current fish, and if I'm able to convince 5 to 8-year-olds that they need to quarantine their fish, you think I'd be able to convince, but essentially that book walks through, you know, what needs to be done to make sure that two new fish coming together are, you know, again, quarantined and make sure that they're introduced appropriately.
I'll say to people, explain it to me like I'm a 5-year-old. So maybe that's a great way to go about it.
yeah, absolutely.
And then I know that I got your Koi on Amazon. Can your other books be?
Yes, they are also available on our Amazon. If you, again, find any of our books online, if you just click me, the author, Jesse Sanders, it'll pull up all of our publications.
Excellent. And how else can people get in touch with you?
So if you are within our service area, so we service currently California and Nevada, mostly northern Nevada. But best way to get in touch with us is to call our phone number. Very easy to remember. It is 866-FISH-VET, F-I-S-H-V-E-T. You can also go online to 866-FISH-VET.com, and that will pull up our main website.
Excellent. And they can also find you on YouTube, Dr. Jesse Sanders, and your website, drjessesanders.com. So thank you so much for joining me for this. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day. I'll also be hired for speaking events if people would like to look at that as well. Check all that out on Dr. Sanders' website. And again, thank you so much for joining me on Water Garden Podcast.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I loved having this discussion with you.
It was my pleasure. Take good care of you soon. Thank you, Dr. Sanders.
Okay.
That was Dr. Jesse Sanders, koi veterinarian, published author. You can find her books on Amazon. You can catch up with her on YouTube, which is at Dr. Jesse Sanders, and her website, drjessesanders.com. Her Koi Health and Wellness program is designed for professionals and offers credits, but is also open to anyone who wants to be a part of the program. How to Kill Your Koi. What a topic. Great book. Check it out on Amazon, everybody. You can find it there. The next episode will be How to Water Pond, everybody. Thanks for being here. I'm your host, Mike Gannon. I'm the owner of Full Service Aquatics, designer, installer, and service provider for koi ponds, water gardens, and water features of all types. And this episode was brought to you by That Pond Place. That Pond Place is the destination location for all things aquatic. Water garden, water features, there are fish, plants, supplies, you name it, located in the beautiful skylands of New Jersey. That Pond Place, thank you for sponsoring the show. And take care of yourselves, everybody. Be good to each other, family, and we will catch you next time here on the pond, the Koi Pond Water Garden Podcast.
You have been listening to the Pond Hunter Radio Broadcast on Blog Talk Radio with your host, Mike Gannon, the Pond Hunter, in the pursuit of all things aquatic, broadcasting Wednesday nights on Blog Talk Radio. The Pond Hunter, keeping it pondy. For the aquatically obsessed.
For the aquatically obsessed. Take care, everybody. See you next time. Peace out.